For the week of January 7th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 394, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And I was almost about to say New York, but that's not true. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Happy holidays, Sperling. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Happy New Year to all our listeners.
That's true. Actually, we had a few listeners that rated and reviewed our show in the iTunes, I guess it's the podcast store. I don't know what you could, in iTunes. Yeah.
Yep, that's in the North American market. We can't see other markets around the world. So if you review us around in Korea or Japan or Australia or the UK, you know, send it to us and let us know because we cannot access them. But we did see that Outside Lady and Jerry, who were two of the people who gave us reviews, 5 stars. Thank you very much. Outside Lady gave us 5 stars. Really, we do want to thank you. And so did Jerry, who wrote, I work in the industry and Showbiz Sandbox is a staple for me. One of my main sources of biz info. Don't ever stop explaining your jokes, Sperling.
Well, so, I'm not explaining them. They're like DVD extras. It's like behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's what it is. So, you got your Christmas wish. People rated and reviewed the show.
Correct. Yes.
I got my Christmas wish. I'm alive.
That's true. You did contact me late yesterday and said, well, I might have appendicitis. I'll let you know if I can record tomorrow. If you don't hear from me, well, then the answer is no.
Yes, it turned out to be presumably just a, instead of saying I had a tummy ache, I'm going to stick with it was a very small kidney stone. So that seems what was most likely based on no elevated blood, white blood cell count, no other symptoms. But it was bad enough. I finally went to a doc in the box and they actually sent me to the emergency room and said, you need to go to the hospital. So thank you for the American healthcare industry, which means I will now face a several thousand dollar bill.
Yes. Well, don't worry. The tax cut will help pay for that.
That's right. And yes, amongst all that, you know, I hope the next president doesn't get in the way of that because people are already lining up for 2020. And I don't mean Hillary and Bernie. I don't mean Kamala Harris or other. I mean Will Smith, Dwayne Johnson, and Oprah all seem to be running for president.
Yes. Well, but Oprah did a very good job of, kind of kicking off her campaign last night at the Golden Globes.
That's right, she did, and we'll be catching that up on the show. But yeah, Will Smith talked about running for president again. He's talked about politics for quite a while. That came up again in a story. Dwayne Johnson keeps talking about it. He's like, no, I'm serious, but I've got a few movies that probably wouldn't be till 2024 because I've got a lot of work lined up. And he has a new hit film, of course, at the box office. And the previous president is going to pop up on Netflix. David Letterman has his Netflix talk show coming, and on January 12th, the first episode drops. I think they're one at a time, and his guest is Obama. So we will be watching Letterman doing what he does in a whole new context with a big beard talking to Obama on Netflix. So it's a crazy new world, isn't it?
Yeah. So he's not shaving the beard. David Letterman, for those of you outside the country who don't know, big talk show host for, 30 years here in the United States. I guess he's not going to shave the beard.
No, it's not happening. But he will be listening to our podcast. And if he does, what will he hear about?
Well, I know he listens every week. And this week on Showbiz Sandbox, okay, we've got a lot, okay? So we took 2 weeks off. There's tons of box office news. We talked about the Globes already.
You took 2 weeks off.
Okay, well, you were sick, sort of. We have some Guild Awards and on and on and on and on. So we'll cover it all. So prepare a snack, pitch a tent, make sure you have plenty of water. There's a bathroom nearby. This is really going to be a long one. We'll try and make it quick, though. Stats are in for the global box office, which set new highs. The Chinese box office caught fire again and is closing in on the U.S. And the U.S. box office, well, it's a disaster. The lowest ticket sales in 20 years and box office is down from last year. And as always, Michael says, take a step back and the big picture isn't nearly so bleak. Our book filter segment returns with a pick ripe for development and some more bad news for Barnes & Noble. I don't know how they could get any more bad news. On Inside Baseball,
they could close down.
That's pretty much it, yeah. During Inside Baseball, we look at the music industry. Spotify is going public just as a new wave of lawsuits threatens to swamp them. The House Judiciary Committee has a new top Democrat, and the music industry is happy about that, while the tech industry, well, they're not. Vivo is hitting profitability. We get more info on YouTube's new music service. And oh, by the way, Jimmy Iovine, remember him? Yeah, he's leaving Apple. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, As always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office, but not only the weekend's box office, the year's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, our listeners, and the number one movie around the world for the first weekend of the new year is Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. $106 million on the weekend, $520 million worldwide. It's now the number one movie in North America. It only costs $90 million to make, so this is a big success story.
Or as Sony likes to say, phew.
Why few? Oh, yes, they hadn't had a big hit in a while, had they?
Well, the Spider-Man movie was a
hit. Spider-Man was a very big hit, absolutely. It was one of the top 10 films of the year, a big success story.
But the Emoji movie, not so much.
That made money as well. That was profitable.
Yeah, it's not as profitable
as they
would
have budget. It made money. It made money for them. It didn't launch a franchise. It didn't give them a glow or, you know, or anything like that, but it made money. So the Emoji movie is not an example of a flop for Sony.
Well,
I'm just saying. But anyway, this is a franchise now. And actually, the original film, somebody referred to it, like Hollywood Reporter Variety, as the classic 90s film, to which I say, whoa, whoa, whoa. Yes, it was released about 20 years ago. That doesn't mean you should call it a classic. It was a terrible movie, but it was successful. That was a hit, too. It cost $65 million to make, but it grossed $260 million worldwide. This one has doubled that. But that first film also spun off an animated TV series and a live-action sequel called Zathura in 2005, directed by Jon Favreau, that really was a bomb, both critically and commercially. That seemed to kill off what was perhaps a modest idea for a franchise. But now Jumanji has brought it well back, and unless Dwayne Johnson runs for president, we're going to see more of them. At number two around the world is Star Wars, The Last Jedi. $88 million on the weekend, $1,205 million worldwide. Far away from the $2 billion that Star Wars The Force Awakens made, but more than Rogue One, it's going to end up in the middle between those two movies. So the Star Wars films, you know, again, our expectations are so out of whack that the fact that it isn't grossing $2 billion, we say, oh, it's kind of falling down. But it's the middle film in the series. They always do, the middle film in a trilogy, I should say. Those always tend to do the lowest, that we tend to see that. So they can perhaps hope for more from the final one. We also saw that China really let them down here. Star Wars is a big hit all over the world, but China has not caught fire yet. The first movie opening weekend, $52 million. Rogue One opened to $30 million. And now Star Wars, The Last Jedi, when they really pushed it, they had a huge marketing campaign. They've got Asian actors in there to try and reach that audience. And it did really disappointed. $28 million on the weekend in China. That's really hurts for them. And any hopes they had of this movie grossing several hundred million and getting them to like $1.5 billion, those are probably gone.
Yeah, Jim Amos over at Celluloid Junkie said this might be one of those movies where you remember how the film ended its box office run rather than how it began.
You mean, does he mean in China or worldwide? Because $1.2 billion is a huge success story.
And he also said that. He said it's funny that you could actually make that much money and it winds up falling into one of those categories where you're like, oh yeah, it did well, but then it dropped off a cliff. You know, it opened well, but then
no, dropped. That's not true. That would be wrong. Anybody who says that is wrong. It has grossed $1.2 billion. It grossed $88 million this weekend, which means it should get to, you know, 1.4 or something like that, or 1.5, depending on legs. So this is a huge success story. They've released three films in the new rebooting. All three have grossed over $1 billion. There's no, unless you're spending $500 million to make them, you know, you're doing great. At number three around the world is X-File 3. This is not a spinoff of the X-Files TV series. It's a romantic comedy in China, and it's a big success. $79 million on the weekend for what is probably a pretty modestly budgeted film. $190 million, almost all of that in the Middle Kingdom. At number four is Insidious, The Last Key, yet another film in the franchise. This only cost $10 million to make. Its opening weekend, it has made $50 million worldwide. So there will, of course, be another Insidious film. At number five is Hugh Jackman's musical, The Greatest Showman. $37 million on the weekend, $150 million worldwide. It cost about $85 million to make. The movie got sort of polite reviews. Our in-house critic, Aaron Rich, said, hey, it's not as bad as I thought it would be. which is, you know, a good compliment sometimes. It's nothing special. It's not good, he said, but it's not the god-awful thing it looked like from the early trailers. It's doing decently worldwide. I don't think they're going to rush it to Broadway like some people were talking about, but it's already doubled its budget. It will probably be fine when all is said and done. At number six is Ferdinand, the animated film about the bull who doesn't want to fight. $31 million on the weekend, $180 million worldwide, doing middling business so far for Fox, not catching fire, not doing terrible, needs to get to $300 million in order to be a clear success story. It may not do that, but as a family film, they'll probably be okay. And number seven is a clearer hit. It's Pitch Perfect 3, the third and probably last film in the franchise. $28 million on the weekend. It's at $140 million worldwide. So while it's not quite up to speed with one and two, nonetheless, it's tripled its budget. You know, it's a success story. What did you expect? People say, oh, my God, it's not doing. It's like, well, what do you think? It's the third in a series that really is barely a series. So, you know, you got to have your expectations be sane sometimes, don't you?
Well, yeah, and I've heard people say the third and hopefully last entry into the Pitch Perfect series.
Well, you know, none of them are great movies. So, you know, I don't know what they're, as if the quality has fallen or what's their deal.
No, I think that they said, look, the first one was fun, right? You know, that was a lot of fun. The second one kind of repeated the first one and, you know, maybe was a little bit raunchier, a little bit funny. You know, it was very funny. The third one, you're really just retreading everything.
Right. And as you would expect, the first one was a pleasant surprise that grossed $116 million worldwide. The second one blew up $290 million worldwide. And the third one is at $140 million worldwide, but they're all modestly budgeted, so they're going to be just fine, and Universal should be happy. And number eight is Coco. This is actually, we've still got like a third of the world to open up in, so the story on Coco is nowhere near done yet. We've got at least another month or two before we know where it ends up, but the Pixar film grossed $25 million on the weekend. It's at just under $600 million worldwide. And number nine is Along with the Gods, The Two Worlds. It's a South Korean fantasy drama. It's sort of a serious spin on Albert Brooks' movie, Defending Your Life. And it's based on a webcomic, and it's about a guy who dies, and he's taken by the Grim Reaper into heaven, and he has like multiple defense attorneys for multiple trials to defend different parts of his life. So sounds like a fun, interesting film. I don't know if it's opened up in New York yet, but it grossed $12 million on the weekend, and it's at $76 million worldwide. It's pretty expensive, too. It looks like it has a $35 million budget. And number 10 is Oscar hopeful Molly's Game, though I think that's probably not likely. But the Aaron Sorkin film grossed $12 million on the weekend. Now that it's finally expanded, it's at $19 million worldwide. And number 11 is Sperling's favorite family film of the year. Perhaps it's Wonder. $10 million on the weekend, $220 million worldwide. A huge success story. They're still probably thinking, how can we do a sequel to this? Wonder gets a date. Wonder prom. Wonder high school. Wonder college. They're going to do something.
Well, don't you think that the author of the book is thinking the same thing? How do I, you know, I think that she does. Augie and Me is the sequel, right?
Yes.
So there is a sequel to at least in the book world.
There you go. And number 12 is Going Vertical. This is a Russian sports drama, sort of their Miracle on Ice. It's a story of the Soviet basketball team snapping the 63-game winning streak of the U.S. team at the 72 Olympics. This is probably emblazoned in their minds while American sports guys, oh, I don't remember that. I've never heard anybody talk about this. But then, but $9 million on its opening weekend. And number 13 is another fact-based film. It's a Korean drama, 1987, When the Day Comes. It's about the overthrow of the military dictatorship that controlled that country in the 80s. Basically, students were rebelling and revolting. Their leader was taken, and he was tortured to death while being interrogated. And people risked their lives to get that news out to the public, including the students who were protesting. And that really set fire to the country, and that's what helped bring down their government, the dictatorship, and install an actual genuine democracy. Thank God for them. $9 million on the weekend. It's at $23 million worldwide. At number 14 is All the Money in the World, the Ridley Scott film that was rushed back into production so they could get rid of Kevin Spacey and put in Christopher Plummer. It worked digitally, at least. They managed to accomplish it. $8 million on the weekend, $27 million worldwide. For a pretty pricey movie, but we'll have to see how it does in other territories. I doubt it will catch Oscar's attention, but you never know. And he's certainly on fire. He's been booked for another movie already. Ridley Scott is the busiest 80-plus-year-old in America. At number 15 is a big, big hit in China. It's Youth, a film we've talked about before. It's a period drama about the early 70s and a cultural troupe in the military. Beautiful young people working in a cultural troupe. $8 million on the weekend. It has now passed the $200 million mark.
Wait a second. Is Ridley Scott 80 years old?
Isn't he? Is he in his 70s?
I don't know, but you know, it's funny. Over the break, I saw I was in a restaurant and Clint Eastwood walked in with members of his family. It wasn't a big restaurant, but man, you want to talk about a guy walking into a room,
turning the heads.
Oh my God, it was unbelievable, and it was very quiet. It was an upscale place, so nobody was making a big scene, but. It was noticeable. And he's 87, and he has a film coming out. Indeed, Ridley Scott, or Sir Ridley Scott, is 80 years old.
Yeah, and he is exactly 80 years old. He turned that in November, and he's got an adaptation of the Merlin Saga, a series of fantasy books by T.A. Barron. So that's a multi-volume project, too, probably. So he's high. He's doing great. So is Gary Oldman. He won a Golden Globe. We'll get to that in a little bit. But Darkest Hour in theaters, $8 million on the weekend, $35 million worldwide. And, of course, that is a long campaign to go. And number 17 is the very well-reviewed family film Paddington 2, $6 million on the weekend, $135 million worldwide. And it hasn't opened up yet in North America. That comes soon.
Comes this weekend, in fact.
Oh, there you go. I'm definitely going to check it out with my movie pass. At number 18, we've got some good news for Venezuela. They have a hit comedy. It's Papita Second Base, or 2DA Base. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right or what they're referring to. I think it's Papita Second Base. It's a comedy. It's a sequel about a couple who got married in the first movie. Now they're raising a son who's like 7 years old, and they both love rival baseball teams. So hilarity ensues. But good God, that country can use some good news. The movie cost about $1 million to make. It grossed $6 million on the weekend, and it's at $42 million and counting. So that's a big, big hit for Venezuela. I'm sure they could use the happy story. Murder on the Orient Express continues to tear it up. That's getting closer to $350 million worldwide. And Kingsman, The Golden Circle, opened up in some new territory. I don't know where. It grossed $4.3 million on the weekend, and that got it just above $400 million worldwide, which compares very favorably to the $414 million of the original.
I want to say that's probably China, no?
I don't know. I don't know where it opened.
Actually, I'm completely wrong. It's not China. I don't know where it opened. That's a good question.
All right. Well, we've got, you know, annual box office figures coming in. Disney is the first and only studio in history to hit $6 billion worldwide, and they've done it twice. They also had a power outage at their park for a few hours that drove people crazy. And we all hear about it because everybody jumps on Twitter and says, the power is out. I mean, that's just a disaster for them. But Universal hit the $5 billion mark for the second time in its history. And the worldwide box office hit $39.92 billion. That's a record high, beating the 2016 number by just about over $1 billion, $1.3 billion leap over 2016.
Yes. And that's what, you know, internationally, yes.
No, that's worldwide.
Yeah,
worldwide,
that's what I mean.
The box office hit a big leap.
Globally.
Globally, worldwide. The international box office was $28.8 billion, and the North American box office was $11.12 billion. The big news internationally is China. It depends on what currency you measure it in. So it gets a little tricky comparing, year to year and growth. But in local currency, it grew about 14% this year. In U.S. dollars, it grew 30%. So in 2016, the Chinese box office was $6.59 billion. So just about $6.6 billion. It leaped $2 billion in U.S. terms this year to $8.6 billion. So $6.6 billion to $8.6 billion. That's getting closer and closer, another 50%, which is a lot, and that's going to have them passing up North America.
Well, now, and you mentioned Universal, yes? Hitting five?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, yeah, and that's always the question with China and currency manipulation and currency valuation and you know, the controversy there. We're not going to get into that. They also, in China, they have a new online fee for buying tickets online, and 80% of the tickets purchased in China are done mobile and online, and that fee is counted in the ticket price, in the box office grosses.
That's true. So that's the first time they've done that?
Yes, it is.
That's right. So they've now instituted that fee. Do the studios get a cut of that fee?
I have no idea. I mean, I have no idea. I would imagine. Well, I mean, that would
if it's part of the box office, if it's just a Ticketmaster fee and they never see it, then that doesn't belong there. But if it is in fact part of the box office gross that the studio gets their percentage of, then I guess that's valid.
Right, and there's a new government mandate that kind of incentivizes exhibitors to play local content, content that's in Mandarin or Cantonese or produced in China.
Well, they've always done that.
They've always had that. So it's actually, believe it or not, if you play 55% or more, you get certain, you know, financial incentives. Ironically, that's actually down. the percentage went from, like, I think in the 70s to 55%.
Yeah, but the happy news is that we do have information on ticket sales in China. All we have in North America is a gross rough estimate of ticket sales. They look at the box office and they say, what was the average ticket price? Well, we guess maybe ticket sales are this, even though they could get that information if they wanted to, but they don't want to share it. And every chain holds on to that info. But ticket sales in China were up. They went from 1.3 billion tickets to 1.6 billion tickets. So China ticket sales are up, but what we can guess from North America is that we think right now about 1.2 billion tickets were sold, and that's on the low end. That looks like it could be the lowest in about 20 years in actual ticket sales. The box office is the second highest grossing box office in history.
Right.
So that's great. And people are saying, oh my God, it's horrible. It's a disaster. Ticket sales have fallen to their lowest number in 20 years. But I feel like if you step back and you look at the last 40 years that the American box office is mature, we've sold more than a billion tickets for 40 years now. And yes, there's a big difference between 1.4 billion and 1.2 and just 1 billion tickets. That's a lot of money actually left on the table. But basically in that middle decade from 1998 to 2007, you know, for about 10 years, Hollywood was selling 1.4 to 1.5 billion tickets. It was a new record high in tickets and in box office grosses. We've fallen back down a little bit because that decade was when you had a final big push on screens and you had 3D and you had all sorts of things going to sort of spark the box office. Now we've got a lot more competition again. It's a mature business. We're not going to go up to 2 billion tickets until the population grows that much. So for 40 years, it's been a good, steady, mature business. This year is no difference. And worldwide, when you look at how sales worldwide are going, we've got, you know, a great future. And that also doesn't take into account the fact that you make a lot more money in many other ways. You know, you didn't make any money on DVD or Blu-ray or streaming or on demand 40 years ago. That didn't exist.
Right. And as we've discussed previously, and certainly with the Disney Fox deal, these studios have become IP management companies. So you know, you make a Star Wars movie. Yes, you make money theatrically, but you also make money in your theme parks. You also make money on merchandise. You also make money on licensing.
And when you focus on North America, to me, that's like focusing on New York or Texas, which of course matters and it can reveal things. It's an important analysis. But when you're making a movie that costs $150 million or $200 million, you are not expecting to make your money back just from North America. Sometimes you do. That's awesome. But you have to have a worldwide vision, which means the worldwide box office is the box office that matters.
Look, in an ideal world, you'd sell more tickets every year, a little bit more, not to, you know, you wouldn't be doubling your number every year. You'd have a nice little increase each year. With maybe a few downticks in certain
What's wrong
years.
With a mature industry where you're just keeping pace with the population and
There's
you know, rising
wrong
ticket
with that.
Price? That's
There's...
great. I mean, everybody goes to the movies and it powers movie sales on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming and all that and your merchandise and your theme parks. So no, I don't think you need to expect an increase every year. I think that's unrealistic at this stage. I think we've seen the U.S. box office basically keep pace with population growth and inflation for 40 years since the 70s. And it's a hugely successful business. They're making more money worldwide. They're making more money in post-theatrical, but theatrical is still the beating heart of the business, which means yeah, you want ticket sales to stay strong, but expecting them to grow is silly.
You know, if I had done my homework, I also would have known whether more or less movies were made this year. I think it's less movies were released this year, specifically because Paramount didn't have any films. I mean, they literally had no films.
That's an even more, you know, when you want to talk about a successful year, what matters more is just going movie by movie and studio by studio, because that's what really matters. Four movies hit $1 billion, Beauty and the Beast, Fate of the Furious, Despicable Me 3, Star Wars, The Last Jedi. Five movies at $800 million worldwide. Spider-Man Homecoming, Wolf Warrior 2, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Thor Ragnarok, Wonder Woman, and Pirates of the Caribbean was just under there at $794 million. So all those movies are hits. You know, Pirates of the Caribbean was not a big success story, but they didn't lose money on it. It made $800 million. And those are a lot of sequels, you know, beauty or remakes or reboots. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm sorry. Nine of them are the only original is Wonder Woman, and she already appeared in an earlier film and is based on a comic book. So frankly, all nine of those movies are part of franchises. So people say people are sick of franchise. No, it's not true. Not even close to true. You know, North America is now expanding to the entire year. That's great news. The second or third biggest hit box office in history, a virtual tie with 2015, which at the time was the highest grossing year in box office history. So, you know, it's been 3 years with the highest or you know, virtual tie of the highest year, you know, three of the biggest years ever. You just can't yell disaster. They had a bad summer. That's what it boils down to. And as you say, if you break it down movie by movie, if they're making fewer movies and basically maintaining their box office success, that's even better news.
Well, and I would guarantee that 2018 is an up year.
The only
not because, and by the way, up on 2016.
17. Oh, okay.
Yes, definitely up on 2017, but I bet you it'll be up on 2016 as well.
Well, that's what we thought this year at the beginning when we looked at all the big movies.
Okay.
And frankly, it came close. You know, it came close. It's the second highest year of all time.
I think also a lot of the mainstream media is making it out. Look, if movie going is down and revenue is kind of maintaining its, you know, it's kind of flat, but still up there and second or third highest in history, it's, you know, ticket prices. Ticket prices are too high.
Well, you know, I can agree with that. I think that there's a lot to be said. You can see the demand for MoviePass. I had a friend in California calling me up. Should I get MoviePass? They've gone from like a couple thousand people.
They now have more than a million. Yeah.
More than a million people. I don't think their business model makes sense, but I do think the idea of a monthly pass for films makes sense. That's why I got one. And yes, I'm going to more movies because of it. And, I think it works. But it only works if the studios and the theatrical people get together and work out a way to make it actually profitable. Hoping to actually make money off advertising or some, you know, information down the road is not a good business plan. Not that they won't necessarily flip it, sell it, and make a lot of money. But as far as the plan itself, until the studios and theaters are on board and working with you, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, given how much money Star Wars made, I mean, it lifted worldwide box office 3% at the very end of the year. That's saying some one movie saying something.
And there'll be another one in summer with Han Solo.
Correct. Yes. Which I loved on the Golden Globes last night. I know we're getting to that. The director of Solo, a Star Wars story, Ron Howard. And I'm like, you mean the guy who came in during the last 2 weeks of production?
Oh, that's interesting. They would call him that. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, we're talking about how to make money with movies. Here's how not to make money with movies, although maybe I'm wrong since, you know, 11 million people watched this film. You spend $90 million on a film that is just panned. I mean, not even, it's not panned, it's just eviscerated by critics.
And that would be the Netflix film Bright, starring Will Smith.
Correct, yes. They spent $90 million on it. Didn't see one movie screen that I know of in the U.S. or worldwide. But 11 million people watched it.
Well, that was only on the first few days, and that's only according to Nielsen. Netflix says, well, it's number one on our site in 190 countries. Will Smith is a worldwide star. They said it was watched a lot more overseas, and they're making a sequel.
What?
Do you think they're so... They're, oh, yeah, they've greenlit a sequel. They're happy with it. They're making money. Same with Adam Sandler. They made money. They're very happy with how it did. I don't think they're going to spend another $90 million just to, you know, say, you say it didn't work, it did. It worked for them. They're happy with it.
No, and when you saw the Golden Globes last night, sitting front and center there, or at least right there in the middle of the room, Ted Sarandos, the content guy over at Netflix.
Yeah, there you go. Well, George Lucas at one point famously said studios would be better off making 100 movies at $2 million each rather than one movie at $200 million, even though that was his entire career.
Yeah.
But I thought that was silly. However, Netflix is happy with it, but when we saw the initial numbers and the horrible reviews, I did think, gee, maybe Netflix itself would be better off launching 9 TV series for $10 million each or making 9 films at $10 million each rather than one film at $90 million, sort of more the Adam Sandler model. But they wanted to play this game of the big tentpole movie, which is sort of a movie you expect to see on a big screen. And for them, they say it paid off. they're making a sequel. I guess that was news to you, so I'm glad we got to share it. You could probably watch it on Netflix, and I bet you could watch it on a, we were talking about a book that's available on BitTorrent, you know, a pirated copy. I bet Bright is out there on a pirated copy. And there was some hilarious stuff over the holidays where people started talking about their movies. Oh, what's his name? The guy who did The Big Sick?
Oh, Kumail Nanjiani?
Yeah, he said, hey, if you wanted to see the film and you can't afford to buy a ticket or you can't afford to rent it on DVD Blu-ray, just so you know, it's available on this porn website under the adult films called Interracial. That's the category it's in. Just letting you know. I mean, I'm sure they took it down an hour. And then a few days later, there was another movie posted on that same porn site, the what's it called? Pornhub. And then somebody else said, oh, the first act of Hamilton, the Broadway original production, is under on this site under Revolutionary Twink Orgasmic Experience, which I didn't even know was a category. But what a bizarre string of like of stuff, and the people suddenly had fun telling us, oh, by the way, that's available illegally. So I'm sure the studio wasn't thrilled, but they also took it down, of course. But kind of a crazy world we live in. Everything is available for free if you want to steal it, and so that's what makes it all the more impressive when you make it available inexpensively and smartly, like with a streaming service or with MoviePass or keeping ticket prices low. That people will show up if you provide a good experience and make it easy for them.
Well, people showed up last night at the Golden Globes, except they were all wearing the same outfit.
That's right. Everybody was in black.
Yes. And that was a kind of in protest or kind of a statement about women's rights and sexual misconduct and, you know, the Me Too movement. And Time's Up actually is now the new movement.
Well, it's not the new movement. That's the name of one, foundation set up to help fight sexual harassment right. And assault and pay for helping people's legal fees and fight for change in the industry. So good for them. The Golden Globes happened. The viewership was about 19 million people. I did not get to watch the opening monologue. I did watch Oprah's presidential nomination speech, but the opening monologue was Seth Meyer. What did you think of it?
I thought it was very tastefully done. I mean, he came out and he said, good evening, ladies, and the one remaining gentleman. You know, he kind of, you know, because that was a live wire, and he is the first during this awards season to go out there in a big broad way to have to address it, and he did a very good job.
Oh, well, there you go. So was it funny?
Yes, there were some very funny bits in it. Not overly funny, not hilarious, but it was funny enough.
And have you started a PAC in order to support Oprah's run for the presidency?
No, but as she was giving that speech, I thought to myself, wow, she is really on fire. And she won the Cecil B. DeMille Award. It's kind of like a lifetime achievement award.
Not won, but was
presented
was honored
with. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Jodie Foster has won it. Meryl Streep has won it. It doesn't always go to a woman. It goes to a whole bunch of people, depending on the year. She won it. She gave a speech that addressed the whole sexual misconduct issue and the, you know, women's, gender equality issue. And it was a rousing speech that literally had people crying. And I don't mean in sadness. I mean, they were literally on their feet roaring. It was one of those things where on Twitter afterwards, people were saying, I was so glad I was in the room for that.
Well, that was the one thing talking about, because the awards themselves don't really matter.
No, I mean, these awards, they're voted on by 90 members of the Hollywood Foreign Press. And
around. That was one of the things our in-house film critic Aaron mentioned to me. Like, they say, how many members do you have? Well, we have around 93. Like, what do you mean around 93? Tell us the number of members you have. How hard can it be? You're all in the room. Just raise your hands and we'll count you. Like, tell us the number of members. But they don't even want to reveal that. That's how sketchy they are. But anyway.
But they throw this party every year. People go to it. And as Frances McDormand said, when she won her award for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, in her rousing speech about women's gender equality, you know, we're not here for the food, we're here for the work. Really, it's not who wins these awards, it's what you say when you win, because you can actually kick off your award season really well during the Golden Globes, or you could end it pretty darn quickly. Just ask Mickey Rourke.
If you just give a bad speech. Yeah, like Tom Hanks gave such a good speech, they wanted to hear it again at the Oscars. Not that he wasn't going to win for Philadelphia, but it certainly helped. He actually gave sort of the same speech, but that's all right. So yeah, they handed out awards. As usual, they share the love. Three Billboards, Lady Bird, and The Shape of Water were all the big winners in film and director. The one thing where they're sort of light on their feet is TV, where they were pretty nimble and gave Best Comedy to The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That was quick and well-deserved, I think. The rest were sort of as expected. I think you said that Frances McDormand did the best job of giving a speech and making you go, yeah, I want to see her win an Oscar. Did anybody hurt their chances that you saw? Was Gary Oldman really boring, or did anybody just do a really poor job and just make you go, whatever?
Well, I'm going to admit that I was in and out of the room as this was taking place.
You weren't in the room as it happened?
I was not in the room when it happened. And so Gary Oldman's speech, I saw it out of the corner of my eye. I didn't listen to it in whole. So I couldn't say. Everybody just thinks, look, it's his to run away with. We've already given Daniel Day-Lewis three awards, so he's not going to win. Everybody seems to think, you know, it's Gary Oldman's year.
I don't know about that, but maybe he's, you know, I think we can tell better from when we get the Guild Awards. So we had the Golden Globes, the National Society of Film Critics. They came in, they weighed in, and they said Lady Bird is their best film. They gave it Best Picture and Best Director, but they gave Get Out and The Shape of Water Best Actor and Best Actress. The real momentum, I seem, is Willem Dafoe for The Florida Project. That it seems to me that it's his year in Best Supporting Actor. But what matters are the guilds, and the Producers Guild announced their nominations, and they're about the 11 films you would expect to see. You know, yes. The Big Sick, Call Me By Your Name, Dunkirk, Get Out, I, Tonya, Lady Bird, Molly's Game, The Post, The Shape of Water, Three Billboards, and the wild card, Wonder Woman. So will those be the movies up for Oscars? I'm sure 7 or 8 of them at least will be, for sure.
Well, yeah, the two things I would point out from the Golden Globes. One was Natalie Portman, and I think it was, I can't remember, was it Steven Spielberg? No, it couldn't have been Steven Spielberg. I can't remember who she showed up with, which is somewhat, oh no, it was Ron Howard. It was Natalie Portman and Ron Howard showed up to give the Best Director Award. And when she said the names of the nominees, she said, the all-male nominees are.
Oh, that's very funny.
And Steven Zaitchek tweeted out, and he's a journalist with the LA Times. He's been on the program here quite a few times. He said that he was sitting near Christopher Nolan, who said, great, all we need to do is lose one more of these and we can go to the bar. Because, you know, Dunkirk just didn't win anything.
Well, that's not a Golden Globe type movie, is it?
No, it isn't.
I still think that will probably get the most nominations for Oscars. I think it will do great on technical nominations. Maybe Shape of Water will do as well, or some other movie. But to me, it's going to have every technical nomination possible. It may not get any nominations in acting because it's just such an ensemble film with such small, quiet performances. Not that it doesn't deserve it, but I think, you know, it'll be close, if not the top nomination getting film, but no acting nominations at all. But the Writers Guild, they also weighed in, and they're always fun because they're sort of quirky. They have good taste. They're certainly a good pick for what might get screenplay nominations for the Oscars. And again, most of the usual suspects, the wild cards here were The Disaster Artist, Mudbound, and Logan. Those were all nominated in the adapted screenplay area. So that might indicate some nomination momentum for them.
Yeah, and they even have documentary screenplay.
They do, though, of course, with the Writers Guild, you have to remember there are, well, the Writers Guild, not so much, but they don't always track the Oscars because there are different rules for the Writers Guild of America, what are eligible. So you have to keep that in mind as well. But certainly getting a nomination doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
But getting a new job doesn't hurt either. Warner Brothers, they've been saying we're messed up with DC, aren't we? And they've made a change, haven't they?
Yeah, I guess they tapped Walter Hamada. Who's kind of he's been an executive for a while, and he's going to head up the DC movies from now on.
That's right. He has been at New Line for a decade, and we were speaking about the Conjuring series. He's been overseeing that at New Line. So he oversaw the recent horror hit It, the Stephen King film, the Conjuring series, including its Annabelle spinoffs, all of which have gotten pretty good reviews, better reviews than the DC films, that's for damn sure, except for Wonder Woman. And he has a good relationship with James Wan, who is directing Aquaman. So all that stuff sort of helps show him, say, hey, he's held franchises. He's grown them. He's gotten pretty good reviews. Now he's going to have a much bigger sandbox to play in, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, DC Films did okay financially this year, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Again, yeah, they're making money. They're just not making good movies.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, in the print world, where DC and Marvel are always head-to-head, they've just released the best-selling comic books of the year, and 7 of the top 10 were DC comic books, whereas 4 years ago, none of the top 10 were DC. So, you know, Marvel has been dominating that area. DC's really doing well. They're doing well in comic books. They're doing well in their straight-to-video animated movies. Those are actually pretty fun and clever. Much better reviews for them than you'll see for the DC live action film. They're doing well everywhere except in the big live action arena. So Walter Hamada's got a lot of good stuff to build on in those other areas. He's got maybe good source material. Certainly they're more popular than Marvel right now, but he's still got a big job ahead.
Well, speaking of jobs, there are some people who had jobs, then they didn't have jobs, and now they want their old jobs back again.
You mean this week in reboots and sequels and spinoffs?
Yes.
I love this. This is, every old show is coming back again. We've got Roseanne. We've got, all this. Now we've got Mad About You. Helen Hunt and Paul Reiser are like, yeah, we're not busy.
Exactly. They literally aren't busy.
But the other one really boggles my mind.
The Office? Couldn't you just do another Office? Why does it have to be The Office? Just pick an office and just do an ensemble comedy.
Well, there's lots of workplace comedies, but it's not even necessarily an all-new cast. It might be about the couple having a kid or whatever and still working. You know, the main couple, Steve Carell, won't be back. But they may have all the old cast. They might have new cast. They might have a mix of old and new. That just seems like an idea. Again, I never thought they should have done it in the first place because the British one was so brilliant. It seemed an awful idea to make that series without the original star. But they did it, and they made money on it. So now they're going to do it again. And I'm sure everybody just says, when the hell are they going to do Friends?
Yeah.
But now Jennifer Aniston has her new show. Is that on Amazon or Apple or Netflix? That's on Apple, isn't it?
I think so, yes. I don't know.
That's her and Reese Witherspoon doing their morning talk show feudy type thing.
That actually could work.
Yeah, no, that's great casting. It's a great ripe area. It's hard to do. They've tried to do a couple movies and TV stuff set in the morning TV show arena. And they're going to try it again, but it's certainly a good cast and, you know, high quality people doing it. But that shouldn't stop her from doing at least a Thanksgiving special for Friends. Come on. They could do like 4 or 6 more new episodes and climax with a Thanksgiving special during November sweeps. Everybody would love it.
Or she could be the mother of the new cast members of Friends.
Ouch. Ouch.
She would never in a million years do that.
No, I wouldn't either.
I wonder if there's any books written about Friends.
Absolutely. Quite a number of them, both at the time and afterwards and retrospectives. They never did like novelization or spinoffs in that way. Hey, there's something they can make money on of. But they did do books about Friends. They do books about damn near anything that makes that much money.
Well, speaking of books, it's time for our book filter segment. Our book filter segment is where Michael dives into the new releases and brings us a book that's ready for its close-up. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
Well, the biggest book of the week we'll get to in a second. That's the obvious big book of the week. But my pick for a book that Hollywood should develop is The Most Dangerous Man in America by Bill Minutaglio and Stephen L. Davis. It's the story of Timothy Leary. Do you remember Timothy Leary?
Yes, the big LSD guy.
That's right. He was a Harvard professor. He did LSD. He was part of the counterculture. Well, at one point in 1969, Timothy Leary was running a campaign for governor of California against Ronald Reagan. He didn't win. Unfortunately. And then in 1970, suddenly he's in prison looking at 10 years in jail because he had 2 joints on him. 10 years in jail for having 2 joints, which is kind of crazy. And he stood there in prison in 1970, looked at the barbed wire fence that was 12 feet tall and said, I can get out of here. And he escaped. He escaped. And then he got the help of the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, all the countercultural people. He was in Algiers. He was all over the world staying away and trying to stay alive and not get captured again. And it became this huge 28-month worldwide manhunt that was hugely, it's nutty and it's crazy and involves every possible character you can think of in the early 70s. And he evaded capture for more than 2 years. And Nixon, President Nixon, was obsessed with him. He sat in the White House, expanding the war in Vietnam. He's drinking and he's furious that Timothy Leary is escaped. And he calls him the most dangerous man in America. And he just spent way too much time thinking about how they should track him down. It is a nutty story. I think it would make a really fun movie. I think Ethan Hawke should play Leary.
Why Ethan Hawke?
Because he's a big fan of the Beats, and I think he'd be fun in it. He needs to do something light.
Now, what's interesting is there is another book called The Most Dangerous Man in America, and it's about the making of Douglas MacArthur.
Making of Douglas MacArthur?
Yes.
There's also The Most Dangerous Man in America, which I think is about Daniel Ellsberg. Yeah, it's a good title. You know, every once in a while, a new person becomes the most dangerous man in America. Some people might say it's Trump, which brings us to the hottest book of the week, which is Fire and Fury. That's, of course, the number one book all over the world. I mean, all over America. Michael Wolff wrote it. Lots of exciting, juicy anecdotes coming from it. The big story for us is not the book itself, but how grossly underestimated its publisher did in guessing how many people would want to buy this book.
Look, Trump himself is the biggest marketer for this book.
That's right. He's been doing them a great service by talking about it all the time and saying it's full of lies. But still, I'm sure they anticipated big sales, but they didn't come even close to what they needed in print. So this book got so much attention. They rushed it out on Friday. Rather, it was supposed to come out this week. They rushed it out last Friday. Barnes & Noble is sold out. Wholesalers are sold out, which means indie bookstores are sold out. Amazon posts right now that it will take 2 to 4 weeks in order to deliver a new hardcover edition of this book to you. And of course, the big fear is that by the time they get books back in stores, people won't care anymore. The excitement will be gone. And there are other books coming out in 2 weeks. And January 16th, we got two more books about Trump. David Frum's Trumpocracy and David K. Johnston's It's Even Worse Than You Think, which is from Simon & Schuster. So there will be other people competing for them. They've got to rush these print books back out into the stores. WikiLeaks posted a full copy of the book at one point online for free. I'm sure it's on BitTorrent sites. You checked it out. In fact, it is, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Not that we're condoning that.
No, not in the least. And what I think has been underreported, not just how poorly they estimated demand, which is tricky to do, but I think most people failed to mention the obvious, which is that in this day and age, while you certainly don't want to run on hardcover copies, you've got digital, you've got Kindle, you've got eBooks, and you've got audiobooks. And you know what? That doesn't run out. And anybody who says, oh, I wanted a copy, and for some reason they want a hardcover, they might just say, I don't want to wait. I'll just buy it on ebook. So they're never going to run out of this book in ebook. They're never going to run out of it on digital audio. And so I think sales that might have been lost in the past, now they can capture them. And there's a lot of people who, for them, this book has never been out of print. They decide they want it, they go buy it. They will have no idea that if they actually drove to a Barnes & Noble store, that the book would not be there and available to them.
Well, if they drove to a Barnes & Noble store, would it be open? That's my question.
Yeah, you're right. It's been a bad year for Barnes & Noble, and the holiday season, which is usually the one bright spot, didn't do them any good either. Christmas for bookstores lasts from around Thanksgiving through the new year. It's a 9-week period where they score a huge chunk of their sales, much more than the equivalent of 9 weeks through the year. You know, they really get a lot of sales at the end of the year. Books are still a great gift. And going into the season, they were boasting about they'd had a big uptick in the fall. They looked good, but it didn't work out. Sales both online and in stores fell 6.4% compared to 1 year earlier for Barnes & Noble. So that's not good news because they weren't doing great 1 year earlier. They've had to revise downward their estimates for the entire fiscal year, which ends in April. Just not good news at all for them. They can't get any good news. The UK, however, they have some good news. They said, we have a turnaround in indie stores. They lost about 1,000 indie stores over the past 20 years. But for the first time since 1995, they have grown in the number of independent stores in the UK rather than fallen. What happened is, they've gone up by one. They added one independent store.
Okay, so
maybe 10 closed and 11 opened, or maybe 50 closed and 51 open. But whatever it is, they added one store this year. So
we didn't go down. That's the good news.
Right. They're still down by like 1,000 stores, of course. So they're not really doing any well. They now have 868 stores in the UK and Ireland. In 1995, they had 1,894 stores. And as we've seen in the U.S., they're often are comparing apples to oranges. Those are independent stores. They're not comparing big chain stores. But, you know, today, if you open up a cooperative and get people to pay you in order to stock your shelves, you're like, we've opened a store. And they say, that's not great. But if the Strand shut down, that would be a much different story, wouldn't it? So, you know, you've got to keep in mind what kind of store opened, how big is it, how many titles are they carrying. So, yeah, it's good news. The fall has stopped. But, yeah, this is not a turnaround when you add one store.
So it's like there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics.
That's right. And then there's sexual misconduct.
Oh, my God, please no.
By the way, thank you for
recommending The Most Dangerous Man in America by Bill. I can't pronounce that guy's name.
Minutaglio
and Stephen L. Davis. I just selected it on NetGalley and I'm downloading it.
Oh, terrific. So there you go.
Yes, sexual misconduct. I don't know where to start. I don't know where to end. It never ends, so I don't know where to start.
Well, over the holidays, I was thinking, hey, maybe people aren't paying attention or people are not coming forward because they're distracted and the media is distracted by the holidays. But no, it ends up there's unfortunately still a lot to talk about. But there's some good news. Time's Up happened. We mentioned that briefly. This happened over the holidays. It was 300 and more Hollywood women came forward to launch a new initiative. It's called Time's Up, and it's a legal defense fund run by the National Women's Law Center. They also, that's to help people who are fighting sexual harassment and can't afford lawsuits. They also have a legislative agenda. They want to increase laws on workplace harassment and discrimination. They're pushing for 50-50 by 2020, that push for parity in studios and talent agencies for women. And it's led by Shonda Rhimes, Reese Witherspoon, and a lot of other women. So that's a substantial change. That's an advocacy group. It's got a lot of financial backing. It's got Oprah. It's got Shonda. Does it have Oprah? It has Shonda Rhimes and Reese. I don't know if Oprah's a part of it. I just assume Oprah's a part of everything.
Yeah. At this point, she's running for president, right? I mean, and it seems Rose McGowan is a part of everything too, especially when it comes to these days, when it comes to, the sexual misconduct movement, if you will. She got a 5-part series about her activism on E! So it's like a docu-series.
That's right. And E, of course, is under fire. A lot of people on the red carpet at the Golden Globes talked about how one of their top anchors quit because she found out not only was she making a little bit less than her male co-anchor, she was making like half of what her male co-anchor. And she's like, that's actually insulting. I'm leaving. So a lot of people brought that up on the red carpet. So that was interesting. And we got an example of what not to do when you face sexual harassment and misconduct allegations. And that would be the Catholic Church, because Cardinal Bernard Law died at 86. He was fled the U.S. in shame, where he should have faced prosecution for his crimes. He hid in Rome, but instead of facing charges and likely going to jail for protecting predatory peace, he was ensconced in glory in Rome. So that was really a shameful blot on the Catholic Church. Frankly, even this day we look, virtually no bishop or cardinal around the world has been punished unless and until outside forces expose their guilt and the church was shamed into it. And that remains true today under Pope Francis, who has had his commission on this issue sort of collapsing a little bit. The two main people who were civilians and had faced child molestation when they were children because of priests and other people in the church, they have left that commission. So they're really not doing a good job. And even to this day, the church policy is not officially that if you hear about a potential crime, you pick up the phone and call the police, which is, of course, exactly what you should do.
Now, just so that our listeners know, Cardinal Bernard Law figures into Spotlight, the movie that won Best Picture a couple of years ago.
That's right. He was in Boston.
Right.
He was a cardinal in the U.S. According to the Massachusetts Attorney General, in the Boston Archdiocese alone, some 1,000 children had been sexually abused by 250 priests over 40 years. Law knew about it even before he took power, and he did nothing but cover it up and lie and knowingly move pedophile priests to new parishes without ever warning parishioners or the police. You can learn a little bit about that in that film and lots of books and news articles.
Well, and I guess maybe two of the big things here this week. Vice suspending some executives after a New York Times story. That New York Times story was a front page story. It was pretty big.
Yeah.
And Paul Haggis, a director who of Crash probably is what most people know him for. He's a writer, director, and he has been accused of rape by a number of women.
Right. And Three of them are anonymous, but they have been spoken to by the media and they've been spoken with. And the one thing that they were asked was, are you related to Scientology? Are you part of the Scientology church? And they insist that they are not. And that has nothing to do with their allegations, because Paul Haggis has faced a number of false accusations and sort of smear campaigns by the Church of Scientology. According to him, he's a person who broke with that cult and has fought against them ever since. And that is the first thing that came to my mind. We'll know more once that continues, but that is something to keep in mind. Not every case is the same. You want to look at each one and say, well, who's talking? Have they come forward? Have other people come forward? What's their background? Is there anything else that might cloud this? You always want to give the benefit of the doubt to the people who are coming forward, because they usually don't do that unless it happened. And that may be the case here.
Well, and then there is Glenn Thrush. I guess he was suspended last year. We talked about that. He is a reporter with the New York Times. He was covering the White House. He was kind of, I don't want to say mocked, but satirized on Saturday Night Live. And he was suspended in December for sexual misconduct. An investigation ensued. He is now going back to work at the end of January, but not on the political beat at the White House.
No, so that's a bit of a demotion, I guess.
Yes, it is. I think. Well, also, I think, like, once you've done that, you know, it's probably smart of them to move him off that beat.
Well, I don't know why. Unless if he's innocent, why would you move him off the beat?
Yeah,
why would you demote someone if they didn't do anything wrong? But I think they found that he did some things wrong, but not enough to fire him. And so therefore, that's why they felt it was appropriate to move him to another position.
Yeah, well, I think that basically they said, look, when you were out there on your own time, you know, in bars and, you know, and restaurants and at events, you know, you got a little tipsy and you made a few passes and it didn't go so well and you didn't behave in ways that, you know, we would condone necessarily, but you weren't at work for the New York Times in those moments. So we can't fire you for that.
Well, we're choosing not to. Yeah, it's not grounds for firing.
Right.
So we've got a link to all sorts of stories in our show notes. You can check them out. Like, the producer of the Florida Project was accused of sexual misconduct. UTA dumped actor Danny Masterson. Hollywood producer Gary Goddard, that's a big one. Anthony Edwards had come forward of ER to talk about what he faced with this producer. And now seven more people have come forward accusing him of child molestation or assault. So that's a big story. But there's been this is the big one. I think it is the Miss America pageant. That's good news.
Well, okay, so you're talking about Gretchen Carlson, right? She was at Fox News, but she's a former Miss America contestant herself, right? Or did she win?
She won. She won Miss America. But she, the news is that when the
she's
going to
head
weeks,
it up. She's going to
well,
lead
the news
the pageant.
Is that, yeah, but in 2 weeks, what happened was, emails came out. Suddenly the leader of the pageant, Sam Haskell, was under fire. So were some board members. There were some nasty mocking emails between him and a head writer for the pageant, mocking pageant winners and mocking their physical appearance and disparaging comments. 50 past winners signed a letter calling on the resignation of him. He's resigned. People on the board have resigned. The head writer was fired. Dick Clark Productions broke ties with Miss America. And now they've installed Gretchen Carlson as the head of the board. Three other winners have taken seat and they're going to pick a new pageant leader. So it's been a from beginning email controversy to whole new people in power all within the 2 weeks of the holidays.
That's how fast the news moves.
Exactly. And good news at the Royal Court, which rather bizarrely canceled a production of a revival of a play about sexual harassment because one of the co-directors faced allegations of sexual harassment. You might think, remove that person if appropriate, and you want to go forward with that show more than ever. I mean, it was written by a woman, co-directed by a woman, and it's about these very same issues. And after sort of people said, well, that makes no sense, they actually said, you know what, you have a point, and now we're going to do this play anyway. So okay. People can learn and they can grow and they can say, you know what, we appreciate your feedback, and it's a big deal when people reach out to us and say, hey, no, wait, you're moving too fast on this. You actually should do that play for a lot of good reasons. And they listened and they learned.
Wait a second. Within that monologue there, I heard.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Two words.
No, I didn't.
Big and deal. It must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Here we go.
Our first story. If you visit New York, the Metropolitan Museum of Art is a must-see, and that is very true. It has been since it opened 145 years ago, and the 7 million visitors in 2017 are proof of that. In fact, I was one of those you know,
so was I.
The Met is the second most popular art museum in the world and the fifth most visited museum of any kind. Well, that all changes in March when the Met starts charging admissions to most visitors from out of state. If you're from New York or a student in the tri-state area, show an ID and you can enter for free. If you're from out of state, you'll have to pay $25. That makes the Met the same as the Louvre, the Smithsonian, and most major art museums around the world by charging a fee to some or most or all of its visitors. The ticket will be good for 3 days and can be used at all Met Museum branches in the city. It's expected to impact 1/3 of their visitors and bring in about an extra $6 million. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's really stupid. And at first I thought, well, you know, but I listened and I looked at the facts and the figures and other people. And I said, actually, it's a travesty on every level. First of all, it brings in $6 million.
That's nothing compared to their budget.
They have an operating budget of $305 million. Admissions brought in $43 million. Now they estimate that they will bring in another $6 million. It will be up to $49 million with this change. Right. And their income has dropped recently. Why? Because their signage at the Met was misleading and let people think they had to pay money. And they didn't, a lot of people didn't realize that they could say, I don't want to pay anything, or I just want to pay $5. They really downplayed that, which was obnoxious because it's city property and they're city funded and they actually don't, it's not privately owned. They don't get to decide what they want to do. They have a contract stating they must provide this service. So in fact, they downplayed it and people realized they had to change their signage. Now everybody who walks and goes, oh, I don't have to pay anything. And fees dropped a little bit, but now they're going to bump it up. They're going to card everybody. Everybody who comes to the Met is going to get carded. You know how stupid and time consuming and wasteful that is? And you got to prove you're as well, I'll bring it next time. I mean, give me a break. It's ridiculous. And they're like, well, kids in the tri-state area, they don't have to pay. Well, why not all students? Why just the kids in the tri-state? Why shouldn't students from Oklahoma who come to New York and get to go to the Met see it for free? And they say, well, look, no other museum does this. And you say, yeah, which is exactly why it's so great. You can walk into Central Park. You can walk into the New York Public Library. Why shouldn't you be able to walk into the Met and say, oh my God, this is available to everyone for free. What a great statement that is.
And that's always been the appeal of the Met, is that it is one of the biggest museums in the world for art from all millennia, all ages, and it's free.
And it brings in, and instead of touting that and making it a bigger deal, they hid that fact for many years because they wanted to trick people into paying.
Now, you know, as I grew older, of course, I'd, you know, here's $5, here's $10, here's $15. Yeah. And so we would, you know, because they had a suggested donation. But $25, I mean, think about it. The Whitney's $25, MoMA, I think, is $25 or $30. You know, all of these museums in New York are now $25 or $30. You could go broke.
A lot of damn money.
Yeah.
That's almost a 3D ticket. But no, it's stupid. It hurts their image. It brings in almost no money. It adds huge complications to getting people into the museum. It's bad for PR. It takes away the one thing that distinguished you from virtually every other major museum in the world. It's stupid on every level.
Well, as we've talked about just a few minutes ago, time is up for sexual harassment, but apparently time is just beginning for women in power. The latest example, the NBC Morning News juggernaut Today. They just announced that Hoda Kotb, or it's Hoda Kotb, actually. I always mispronounce her name. She will be the new co-anchor alongside Savannah Guthrie. Kotb has been hosting the 10 a.m. hour alongside Kathy Lee Gifford and a bottle of Chardonnay and endless glasses of wine. I should read before I speak. But Kotb has also had a longtime presence in the earlier hours and has been the fill-in anchor since Matt Lauer was kicked out. And now it's official, for today at least. Women in charge. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's not the first time Diane Sawyer and Robin Roberts co-hosted Good Morning America for 3 years.
That's true.
But it's very cool. She's a big figure on the show. She's an interesting balance. Savannah Guthrie will now become the serious one. I assume she'll be doing all the big, heavy interviews with world leaders and figures like that, where Hoda Kotb will be the lighter one. But she's been present on the earlier hours the whole time. So it's an interesting pick. It's a popular choice on the show, of course. And I'm sure it'll be popular with viewers.
Well, she certainly got them into first place again, but I think that was more out of curiosity than anything else.
Yeah, but it's a familiar face. You know, the big thing is to not, you know, oh my God, they got to learn somebody new and get used to them and see how they work with everybody else. There's no problem with the chemistry here. It's not, it's going to feel very seamless. So I think that's the big plus.
American football took a hit in the TV ratings last year. Get it?
You see, I do. I do.
Okay. The number one show in the country is Sunday Night Football on NBC, but it dropped 13% in the ratings compared to its rank 1 year earlier. It's still the number one show in the country, but like American Idol and All in the Family and other big hits of the past, when you're number one, there's really nowhere to go but down. Thursday Night Football fell farther, while ESPN's Monday Night Football dropped a modest 5%. Year to year, when it's all added up, viewership for football TV is dropping about 8%, which is less than viewership fell just 1 year earlier, which means we have 2 years of declining viewership. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. They've just expanded the market for football too much. It's on too many nights of TV. They're making tons of money. It's still the number one show in the country. So there's nothing really to care about other than saying, hey, maybe you expanded too much and Thursday was, you know, a night too far. But they're making money on all those nights, so they're probably going to stick with it. But ESPN is now the number one cable channel in the fourth quarter. They got back on top. That hasn't happened in a while. So they're averaging 3 million viewers in prime time. Total viewership all day rose 9%. Prime time rose 13%. Their Monday Night Football franchise is a big part of their success. They love that. So they're all profitable. And the day games on Sunday, they make them tons of money. So football is not going away. And as you said, it's the second year that they've had some declines. So the decline is slowing. It's not about the protest of players. It's about viewership and the fact that they have expanded football so much. There's just too damn much of it.
Lady Gaga continues her mad dash through an entire career in just one decade. She's gone from a massive debut album through declining sales, pivoted to older genres like jazz, sung The Sound of Music at the Oscars, attempted a pop comeback that failed, and is now settling down to a residency in old age. Yes, Vegas used to be the domain of acts your parents loved, and newer ones who had fallen hard and fast. That explains why Gaga will share time with Cher, who is also doing a Vegas residency. But so is Bruno Mars. And Gaga will be the lead in the umpteenth remake of A Star Is Born in 2018. So her career is not fading away, but just kind of getting started. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It used to be a big deal. You think, oh, your career is over, or what a strange thing to do. But now you're just like, oh, sure, why not? Makes sense. Make people get there to you.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, make people come to you rather than you go to them. So it makes perfect sense now.
Yeah, that's what residencies are for. I mean, the Rolling Stones thought about doing that because Keith Richards, they thought, you know what, he's not really travelable anymore. And so let's do like these long gigs where you spend a month at the O2 Arena or something like that. Billy Joel does it at Madison Square Garden. Elton John is there at the Coliseum in Las Vegas. So is Celine Dion. They kind of switch off. Rod Stewart is also there.
Yeah, exactly.
Broadway is kicking up its heels. The theater engine of the U.S. hit a record high of $1.6 billion in sales for all of 2017, and of course can add in billions more with off-Broadway, regional theater, and touring productions that circle the globe. That's a big leap over the $1.3 billion of 2016, and that was a record as well. Broadway ended the year with the highest grossing week in history, racking up $50.3 million in sales. You can thank soaring ticket prices, which producers loudly insist is money that would have gone to scalpers anyway, so it's not like people spent more money, it's just more of that money went to the people who rolled the dice on a Broadway show. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's both great news, but it's also terrible news because it really is about grossly exploding Broadway ticket prices. They are making Broadway completely out of reach for anyone. Even casual fans who would go to in previews, you cannot get decent cheap seats. It's just become a disaster. Hamilton, Springsteen, Bette Midler, these are just the latest examples of what's been going on for a few years, but it's really out of control. It's a terrible, terrible trend. And the fact that they say they have to charge these prices or they're just keeping it away from scalpers is BS. In London, for example, Hamilton has gone totally ticketless. Which you can't do in New York, and it's really helped them keep tickets out of the hands of scalpers, yet they're still charging record high prices. So they can keep them out of scalpers like Springsteen did with their pre-approved fan, verified fan thing. That kept most tickets away from scalpers, but they still charge a ton of money. So you know what? They can charge $850. There'll always be some sucker to pay it for the hottest show in town. But what they're doing is killing off that steady audience that they need to depend on when they have a new show that nobody's excited about, or those middling shows like War Paint with great Broadway veterans, Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole. And it's not going to make a lot of money, but they can depend on that fan base to turn out. But nowadays, that even that becomes impossible because it's too damn expensive. I know people who go to every Broadway musical. They want to see them early in previews. They go 2-3 times, and they're cutting back because they simply can't afford it. Broadway is killing that core audience that they need to get excited, to spread the word of mouth, to get the shows going, and just make it accessible so people can come to New York and not think they have to, you know, sell one of their kids in order to see a Broadway show.
The production company behind the hit TV show The Walking Dead was hit with the maximum possible fine after the death of a stunt person. The government's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, investigated and cited failing to protect employees from fall hazards. That's the fine that they got. That's the reason for the $12,675 fine. It was labeled a serious violation rather than the more serious repeated or willful. So if it got the maximum fine, why wasn't it in a more serious category? That's my question. Also, lacking in trade industry coverage was exactly why they were fined and what they failed to do, other than the tragic fact that a stunt person died. Nonetheless, OSHA said this fine should serve as a wake-up call to the entire industry. That's a fine? That's like the craft services budget for the week. Big dealer, big whoop.
Maybe it's the highest fine for that category of a infraction.
Maybe.
I tried to figure that out and I was unable to do so. If somebody dies for any reason, you would think the fine would be higher than $12,675. That really does not make any sense for a TV show that's been, on a major cable channel. And this isn't like a straight to, streaming my, I'm putting it up on my own website. You know, this is a big show. That seems bizarre, and I'm sure it's upsetting to the family to even hear that figure be announced. You know,
right?
Oh, your son, your brother, your husband, your father died. We'll charge him $12,675. So that makes no sense to me whatsoever, and I still don't know what they did wrong. Obviously, it went awry. Accidents can happen, but what did they do? Some step that they should have done? Was something not locked? Was something not? I mean, clearly something went wrong, but was it something that they should have done? You know, we don't know. So it's very confusing.
Megyn Kelly is not going to like this. NBC announced that music superstar John Legend will be playing the title role in their live TV musical production of Jesus Christ Superstar.
He's not white.
Well, you know what? It doesn't matter. Legend had a supporting role in the Oscar-winning La La Land, but this will be his first lead performance. He joins rocker Alice Cooper, who plays King Herod, and Sarah Bareilles, who will play Mary Magdalene. The musical is often cast in concert with pop stars rather than actors, and the show will air on Easter Sunday, April 1st. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Yeah, I think it's a natural progression for John Legend. I don't think he's going to turn into a big actor. He seems to be sort of his range so far has not wildly impressed me, but this is a show in particular that's often done in concert, often done with pop stars playing these roles. They tried to tour it recently and that sort of fell apart, but this has happened a lot. It's a show where if you can sing, you can get by. There's not much acting to do. You just got to sing the songs and nail them. And, you know, he's won 10 Grammys. He's won an Oscar for co-writing the song Glory for the movie Selma. And he got a Tony for being one of the producers of the revival of Jitney. Did you
get
what I said there? He's got a Grammy. He's got an Oscar. He's got a Tony for 3 different projects, by the way. So all more credibility to him. The man needs an Emmy. And if you didn't get the Megyn Kelly joke, she once said on Fox News that Jesus and Santa were white.
Oh, okay. I was trying to figure that out.
She's a little ignorant. Yes, it's like one more reason to think, okay, I'm glad Megyn Kelly spoke out about sexual harassment of Fox, but not necessarily a person I love.
FX head John Landgraf gave another report on the state of TV. When he's not wondering what the merger of his channel with Disney means, Landgraf is busy counting up all the scripted shows on TV. This year, by the way, it hit 487, a new record high, and about 1/4 of them, 117 to be exact, are from streamers like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and the like. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Somebody else, I should have known who, but they broke it down into the number of hours that are being done, which is great because, you know, one 6-part episode of 22 minutes each on Netflix is not equivalent to 22 episodes on CBS. So, you know, that's a good distinction to make, to add up the hours and, you know, exactly what's being made and how many hours of scripted TV, not just the number of shows. That's even better detail and granular information. But here, what blew my mind is that 1/4 of them are from streamers. Wow.
Yeah,
that's lot of programming on Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and all over the place, and Apple. That is amazing. There's all these shows, 1 out of 4 of them are on streamers. So, well,
why do you think Rupert Murdoch, when the deal with Disney was announced, he said, look, you know, you've got all of these tech companies entering the space and they are spending billions and billions and billions of dollars, or as they like to call it, chump change, to make content. And it's going to be very difficult to keep up with that.
And it's going to be difficult to monetize them all. At some point, you know, that's the issue of peak TV. You know, there's so much TV. There's this show, The End of the Effing World. Is it on Netflix, I think? Got great reviews. And Aaron watched it, and he said it was really good.
Aaron Rich.
But there's so darn much stuff out there. You know, who's making money on what? The numbers don't quite add up. But there'll have to be a shakedown at some point, or maybe there's just an endless appetite for TV.
Ringo Starr and Barry Gibb. I just wanted to let that sit there for a second. Ringo Starr.
Okay.
Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees, of course. They were knighted by Queen Elizabeth II. According to year-end honors announced by the palace, Yoko Ono put it best in a tweet to Ringo saying, "It's about time," which I think maybe she got that wrong. I don't know.
It's about time. What do you mean?
Time's up. That's the...
Oh, no, that's different.
Maybe the royals were a tad nervous. The Beatles were given MBEs during the height of the Fab Four's reign, but John Lennon later returned his in protest about peace. Paul McCartney was knighted in 1997, so when George Harrison was offered the lesser title of OBE 3 years later, he said, no thanks. As for Gibb, that too comes 40 years after his heyday, and with Barry Gibb as the sole remaining member of the group. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. Happy for both of them. You have to think it's about time. Like, what the hell took so long? And how insulting to George Harrison. Like when you knighted McCartney in 97, why not George and Ringo, for the love of God? And if you wanted to wait to make sure the Bee Gees were an enduring institution, as was pretty clear, probably by the Saturday Night Fever phase, you know, you do want to wait if you're going to knight someone. But I think 20 years after that, you could say, yeah, the Bee Gees are an institution. You know, maybe we should recognize them being Australian lads, making it big, one of the biggest acts in the world of all time. You know, now the other two guys are dead. Well done. So I'm glad that Ringo got it. I'm sorry that they insulted George Harrison like they did. And I'm sorry the other members of the Bee Gees are dead and can't enjoy it. So, you know, get on the tip.
Well, you know, now that they're knights, if Britain is ever invaded, all of these guys are going to have to come back and defend the throne.
They're going to have to get horses. They're going to have to get people to lift them up under the horse. Yeah, it's going to be
learn how to joust. It's
learn how to joust. There's a lot to do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And indeed, this week, everybody is talking about Spotify and about how Spotify has quietly and surreptitiously announced their IPO for the first quarter of 2018.
No, they haven't.
That's right, because it's going to be a direct public offering.
Which really makes it sketchy. All right. So in a direct in an IPO, you have a dog and pony show. You go around, you get investment bankers to underwrite your shares. People get a sense of where the demand is. It's very official and classily done, you know, but with a direct public offering, you skip all that. There's no pitches to big players, no investment bankers underwriting the shares, no dog and pony show. In fact, this is the biggest DPO ever. So what they're saying is they're hoping casual investors, day traders, grandma and grandpa who are worried about, you know, their retirement or trying to become a day trader, they're going to say, well, I've heard of Spotify, and they're going to buy stock in it.
Right. Now, here's the thing. When you have an IPO, somebody has to sell your stock, right? Like, you can't do it yourself. You're not hawking it out of your garage. Okay. Uh-huh. So somebody has to, and it's usually an investment bank. So figure, you know, Goldman Sachs or, you know, one of these big, you know, Credit Suisse, one of these big banks will go out there and you'll have to buy the initial stock from them. But to do that, of course, they need to vet it. Okay. So Credit Suisse or Goldman Sachs, they're not going to just sell anything. And so when you go to Goldman Sachs or Credit Suisse, and I keep using those two just to kind of for continuity, you assume as a stock buyer that they've done their homework and they're not selling you a piece of garbage. When you're buying...
Which is not a safe assumption anyway. But anyway,
right.
That's a different story for the crime of the century that was the 2008 collapse. But anyway.
Correct. But when you're buying directly from the company, okay, they're basically telling you, yeah, we're fine. You know, here's our prospectus. Here's some information about us. Do your own research and, you know, buy from us. And
save money.
And by the way, that does save Spotify a lot of money.
That's right. And they have some good news. They lost $600 million in 2016. Wait, that's not good news. Well, it's not good news, but I think it was less than the year. I think it was more, which means their viewership is growing. So that's great news. We've got more listeners like me, Michael Giltz. I have Spotify now. And they did sign new contracts with a lot of the major record labels that will improve their margins. So that's the good news that they have. What's the bad news? Oh, they hit 70 million subscribers. Also good news. That's why they're losing more money than ever, because every time they are get new subscribers, they got to pay more out to the record labels. All good news. What's the bad news?
Are you referring to this $1.6 billion lawsuit, this copyright lawsuit?
I might be.
Yeah, that, so I think, is an opportunity. Look, nobody's, I mean, if anybody gets $1.6 billion for a copyright lawsuit for a record label that is like, who is this company? Wixen? You know,
they have some of the biggest artists in the world on them. It's a publishing company. No, they have tons of, right. Tons of artists. No, they have some of the biggest names ever.
So here's what's going on with this lawsuit. $1.6 billion is a please settle lawsuit. Okay. But it's also a matter of there's this new legislation that is quickly making its way through the House of Representatives called the Music Modernization Act. And it's a major overhaul of copyright and licensing, specifically geared toward digital. And it would give this blanket license for digital, much the way, you know, there's a broadcast license. And if you pay
radio, yeah.
If you pay into it, you can play, but you got to pay into it. You can't like not pay into it. And so
bars and restaurants don't have to work out things. If they want to play the radio or have bands play, they just get the blanket license and they're taken care of.
Right. They pay their, you know, regular dues and that's it. They don't have to go to every record company and say, oh, we're going to play, you know, maybe, some Stevie Nicks. So, who represents, they just pay into ASCAP or BMI or, you know, the broadcast license and it's taken care of.
But well, digital is a mess and they want to clean it up. I'm not sure. I know the record labels are happy with what they're trying to push, but are artists happy?
I don't know yet. That's a good question, but here's what I do know. The one thing this legislation states is that it will apply from the date it passes moving forward. Any lawsuits that are ongoing remain ongoing. So, of course, this company Wixen comes in and sues Spotify for $1.6 billion because they need to get their lawsuit filed. And
right, they want to file it.
Right.
And they're a music publishing company, not a record label. They have Tom Petty's Free Fallin', Light My Fire by the Doors, and tens of thousands of other songs.
Correct.
Who are not getting the compensation they deserve. So this is not some nobody making up a big number. I mean, everybody makes a big number to get headlines as far as $1.6 billion. But this is a major player with a lot of songs under their file. And they're acting now because of that, and also because Spotify did reach an agreement with some other publishers who sued them that was a class action lawsuit and that was settled for $43 million, but it hasn't been approved yet by a judge. And a lot of people have weighed in and say, hey, we don't agree with this. We don't think this should be approved. That's why two other much bigger lawsuits were filed after that settlement. And now Wixen has weighed in as well. So they're saying, hold on a second. This is not good for us. We're not happy with this lawsuit. Spotify is going to get away with having broken the law willfully for all these years. They need to pay more money. This legal thing is happening in Congress. We need to lay our marker down now.
Yeah, and I guess now you have Spotify now.
I do.
And do you like it?
I do. It's a whole new world. You know, it's a little stressful for me not actually having the music and having to load it in and out, and maybe stuff will not be available, not everything. So it's a new way of thinking of the world. But yes, I'm essentially happy with it.
And did you have Apple Music before that?
I had nothing.
You had nothing.
No streaming service.
Okay, none. Because Apple Music, you know, there's all these services out there. You got Pandora.
Right. And before you decide to invest in Spotify, I would point out that Pandora went public more traditionally at $16 a share. They peaked at $40 and they're now trading at below $5.
Oof.
So,
yeah.
You know, think twice.
Yeah. Until, you know, yeah, I don't want to even get into the problem that is the licensing for these models because it's So problematic. So problematic that Jimmy Iovine is pretty much out. He, of course, works at Apple, but he worked at Beats before that. He's a big music producer and a big music executive. And he and Dr. Dre started Beats. And when Apple bought Beats, they both, Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, went over to Apple. They thought, Jimmy Iovine could help them start Apple Music. He did. There's 30 million subscribers at Apple Music now. So they've pretty much, that's up and running. If they can't sign licensing deals with 30 million subscribers without Jimmy Iovine, they probably shouldn't be running a music service.
Right. And his shares are fully vesting. So that's why he's leaving now.
This is not a shock. In August, his shares, it's a 4-year plan. You always do the four. That's very, very common. When a company is acquired, you get acquired for cash and stock. The stock isn't given and it's doled out periodically over time. That's called vesting. And it's usually a 4-year period. August is the end of that period. That's usually when people will leave.
Yeah, so they locked him in for 4 years. He's gone, but I don't know what he's going to do. I mean, he's been creating original content at Apple. I'm not sure what new task he wants. He's been on American Idol. I mean, what's his next gig? I don't know. You would think there's a lot more to accomplish at Apple, and they've got big pockets. So it'd be fun to see what he does next, I guess.
Yeah.
But it was fun to see what's happening on the House Judiciary Committee. Speaking of the legislation moving through over the holidays, Jerry Nadler is the new top-ranking Democrat. And that matters because he beat out Zoe Lofgren, another Democrat, and he is seen as very pro-music biz, whereas Lofgren is closer to the tech company like Google and Apple, and she's kind of weak on copyright. That's the music industry perspective on them. So the music industry is very happy that Jerry Nadler is now the new top-ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee because that will affect copyright, which is what we got going on with this Music Modernization Act. So all the pieces are coming together. They've got the legislation. They've got a Democrat that they feel is very pro-music industry. And in 2018, if they take back the House, he will not be the top-ranking Democrat. He will be the head of the Judiciary Committee in the House.
Okay, so...
So that's going to help get them through the legislation they want to get through. Because he's very pro-music biz, and he's been on top of copyright and all these issues for quite a time now.
Now, what did you make of this whole Vivo thing? Vivo is actually making money. Vivo is, it's like a music video. It's like MTV, but for YouTube.
Well, I was a little shocked. Their revenue grew 30% last year. They're owned by Universal, Sony, and Warner Brothers, to which I say antitrust much. Vivo was owned by those three labels.
Well, they can, they're making the content. And by the way, music labels always made music videos. They just gave them to MTV and to television networks. And, they were out there for use. Now what they're doing is they're saying, we'll just put it out, we'll distribute it ourselves. So they're manufacturing and distributing. You're right. They're vertically integrated.
Yes. And their gross revenue was $650 million in 2017. That's because they hit 25 billion views a month.
Wow.
And the news is that they just broke even this year. To which I say, why would Vivo just break even? Is this like a loss leader where they put a lot of their expenses onto it so that they can write it off on their own books? Because, Vivo's not paying for the videos unless that's how they, unless they just throw, you would think it'd be very cheap. It's just a platform. You're given the videos for free by your record labels. So I guess maybe they're moving the costs over onto Vivo and saying, that's losing money or that's just breaking even, but they get to have other areas be more profitable. That's all I could think of.
Well, tech infrastructure as well. You need to have CDNs all over the
Sure, yeah. But $650 million, 25 billion views a month. I mean, you got to have the infrastructure. But for a while, they're mostly hosted on YouTube. A lot of their stuff is on YouTube. When you look up YouTube artists on YouTube, a lot of the time I'm clicking on their Vivo account.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. So I don't quite sure, unless it's an accounting thing, why they just broke even this year. But it does, they got a big global audience. They're making investments in millions of dollars of music videos, which I guess now makes sense. I was kind of wondering, why are they still spending so much money on music videos when they're not pushing album sales? But I guess they're making money on the music video itself, which they almost never did, because they get to put ads on it. And, that makes them money. I'd love to know what the economics are. Who makes the money and where? Is this another case of the labels making money by pushing the music videos onto Vivo, doing over there, and the artists get cut out?
Well, let us know.
Somebody should reach out. If you know about music business, they should let us know. How would they get in contact with us?
Well, they can reach us dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And I'd like to thank the fax machine that's been calling us and leaving 5-minute fax messages for us for the past month and a half. It's really can't helpful.
Can you block that phone number?
They're different phone numbers, but it's a nightmare.
Well, you know, we were speaking about copyright, and there was an artist who posted a video of white noise on YouTube for whatever reason, and he got sued by 5 different copyright holders for copyright infringement.
Wonderful.
And he said, actually, some of those people were selling white noise videos for sleep therapy, and that was their business, they claimed, but, like, it's white noise. It's, like, literally not anything. So I thought that was hilarious. Is when we want to talk about how messed up copyright is and policing piracy online, it's a nightmare. But I did want to also mention before we say that the YouTube remounting is dead, you know, YouTube's attempt to launch a streaming service yet again, before we write it off completely, we should point out that now we do know their new music paid service is an upgrade of YouTube Red.
Okay.
We still don't quite know how it's going to work, but it's not a new service. It's like they're redrafting Red and trying to make that work finally. They did sign deals, of course, with Universal and maybe Sony, so we will find out. So let's not write them off as dead quite yet.
Okay, well, one thing I know is that some people, unfortunately, are dead, including, and I know that's a horrible trend. I do that every week. I do a horrible transition into obituaries. You should never hand that off to me. It's like
there's no way to have a good transition to you're dead.
Yeah, you pretty much. Rick Hall, and if you don't know his name, it's because he was behind the mixing board for some of the biggest acts around. The Muscle Shoals sound was his sound. He was akin to Stax, which was a nearby record company. He was responsible for Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, Etta James, some of the famous house bands, including Duane Allman. He is a big record producer. Actually, there was a Muscle Shoals documentary made a couple of years ago, worth seeing.
He died at 85, and he wasn't responsible for Aretha Franklin, but she recorded in his studio. In one day, she recorded I Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You and Do Right Woman, Do Right Man, two great Titanic singles. And but that day ended with Hall getting in a fist fight with her husband, and she never recorded with him again. So it was not every day ended well, necessarily. So that was sad. But that was sad in the music industry. In the book industry, Fred Bass died. He was a mainstay at the Strand Bookstore. He took over his dad's store, which was on like 4th Avenue, I think, at the time. And he was working there since he was a little kid, moved it. You know, there were like 50 bookstores, used bookstores along 4th Avenue at one point. And in 1956, he moved it to its current location at Broadway and 12th Street. Like the Met, it's a must stop if you go to New York and you like books. And it's free. You don't have to pay to walk in. They had 500,000 books in the mid-60s, 2.5 million books by the 90s. They now claim to have 8 miles of books. It's just a landmark in the book industry. He came up with the literary quiz for potential employees, which people love to talk about. And the only reason, despite all his savviness, despite all his, you know, changing with the times, the only reason the Strand is still around is because in 1997, 20 years ago, they bought the building it's housed in for $8.2 million. If they didn't own that property, they would probably be replaced by a Duane Reade long ago.
Yes, and that would be incredibly sad. That is by far every time I'm in New York, I will go into the Strand. I don't often buy stuff there. I don't know why. Probably because I don't want to take it back. But just going into that store, I mean, I cannot urge people enough who are visiting New York, go to the Strand. And much like going when you're in Oregon, Portland, Oregon, go to Powell's Books. Those are two bookstores in the United States that you have to visit. Now there's one here in Los Angeles called The Last Bookstore, yes. But that is slowly gaining that type of reputation. But the Strand is where it all started.
Absolutely. It's very cool. Very fun. You walk in and you say, oh my.
Yes, it's overwhelming.
Now, that was my segue to Dick Enberg, a broadcasting legend. He died at 82, and his catchphrase was, oh my.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
He was really known well for, I mean, he was really versatile. Baseball, basketball, and tennis were among his areas of expertise. There are sports broadcasters who were known just for one sport. Dick Enberg could do a lot of sports, and I see him in a way as a precursor to Bob Costas. So if you're thinking what Dick Enberg's impact was like, I'd say it's akin to Bob Costas in the sense that he just excelled in so many areas. And he knew my mom. Because, you know, she was a tennis umpire, worked all the slams. So, you know, he wouldn't say, hey, we didn't call her up and go out to lunch, but he knew my mom, so that's kind of cool. So goodbye to Dick Enberg.
Well, and goodbye to Sue Grafton. I'm surprised you didn't want to take this one. Of course, she was the best-selling mystery novelist, and she died of cancer at the age of 77.
That's right. She was the creator of a long-running series that played off letters of the alphabet. The private eye she created was Kinsey Millhone, and the series began with A is for alibi, B is for burglar, C is for corpse, and so on. She sort of did it on a whim when she started, but then, of course, it became a lifelong project. And she long refused to have her books adapted into movies or TV shows because when we worked on other projects for Hollywood, she said that kind of cured her of any desire to have anything to do with them ever again. So she really did not have a good time in Hollywood. And furthermore, she told her kids, I will haunt you if you let anyone else continue the series after I die. I will haunt you. And so perhaps she was fated to die soon. I don't know. Because she published Why is for Yesterday in 2017. People were talking about, what is she going to do next? What will she do after the letters are done? Well, she died before she reached Z. God bless her. And in a tweet after her death, her daughter said, as far as they're concerned, the alphabet ends with Y.
Oh, that's actually a good tweet.
That's very sweet. Yeah, that was very thoughtful, I thought.
Well, the film world is in mourning because of Dan Talbot's passing. He was the Lincoln Plaza Cinema owner. And kind of an accidental
and
film
distributor. Booker, I don't know if he was the owner. He's certainly the impresario and the booker there. I don't know if he owned it.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
I'm not sure about that. Yeah.
He was just so associated with it. I just assumed he owned it.
Maybe he did. I know he ran it for decades.
Yeah. But he also became an accidental film distributor.
Yes, that's true. He was at Lincoln Center for decades, which was a great place that really supported genuinely independent and world cinema. Sadly, he lived just long enough to hear that Lincoln Plaza was closing for good. So I think that maybe killed him. So thank you, whoever shut down the Lincoln Plaza. But no, he was in his early 90s, so he had a long, full life. And he'd had failing health in recent years, which is why he had sold off the New Yorker Films. He sold that in 2009. He founded it and ran it from 1965 for 45 years. He began with Bertolucci's debut Before the Revolution. He did a lot of Godard. He did Chan is Missing, the quintessential New York art film in my mind, My Dinner with Andre, the sort of film that people who are not into film go, what? It's about two guys having dinner.
Yeah,
sit down, they have dinner, and that's it? Like, they can't handle it. Their mind explodes when they hear about that.
Inconceivable.
That's true. So if your family or friends of Dan Talbot, stop listening now, because now we get to the bad stuff. Because he was a positive force in the early years. He did great stuff with New Yorker Films. He did great stuff at Lincoln Plaza. However, he had his bad side. New Yorker had terrible prints and didn't keep them up. He held on to movies and wouldn't make individual titles available for rent. In the 70s, he had such a great, impressive library, akin to like what Criterion has on DVD and Blu-ray, but he refused to let you book it. You couldn't just say, I wanted to do Romero films and book Romero films for your independent movie house. Just to get access to any particular film, you had to book like a New Yorker film festival. So it made it really onerous and difficult to get access to the movies. And when you got them, they were really crappy prints. And that meant movies like The Mother and the Whore and Jacques Rivette's Celine and Julie Go Boating and a lot of others remained unseen for decades. So, you know, he did a lot of great stuff. He was very influential. But that period for 20 years, 30 years sort of messed up, some reputations for directors because their films just weren't seen and they weren't doing great prints. So there's a good side to New Yorker Films. There's a bad side. There's really only good news to say about Lincoln Plaza. He certainly has a lot of a legacy to be proud of, but it's not all pure goodness and light.
Speaking of a long life, though, you have the child star and singer Rose Marie, who,
oh my gosh,
died at 94.
One of the few people to transition to adult success. She began as Baby Rose Marie at age 3. She had her own radio show at age 5. She was a nightclub singer as a teenager. She did radio, vaudeville, nightclubs, Vegas, TV, movies, Broadway. And she'll always be remembered, of course, as the single gal on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
And what's weird is that literally just like, I think it was last month, a documentary was released about her.
That's right. My friend TJ went to see her in New York. They had a screening of the film about Rosemary's crazy career. And she was there in person. You got to see her right before the end. So that was very cool. It's a decade-spanning documentary. It's not a great documentary as a film, but she's got a really interesting story, so it's fun to see. So yeah, you know, she actually thought she was going to be the star of the Dick Van Dyke Show. She was kind of pissed when it turned out it wasn't her, the female star, that it was, you know, Mary Tyler Moore. So she was not happy on that show, unfortunately, but I think ultimately she made peace with it because it was a great role and a great show. And, you know, Carl Reiner tweeted very nice thoughts about her. And there's another link to the show who just died, and that's Jerry Van Dyke, Dick Van Dyke's younger brother. Dick Van Dyke was the other star of the Dick Van Dyke Show, obviously, along with Mary Tyler Moore. And Jerry had two really famous episodes. It's like a two-parter where he was Dick's banjo-playing nightclub comic, sleepwalking younger brother. He came on the show and he sleptwalked. And that was the shtick. And that sort of, you know, he'd been fighting in nightclubs and trying to get attention. And he almost was on the peak of success, just about to, you know, grab the brass ring. He was offered two roles. He could play Gilligan on Gilligan's Island, or he could play the lead in My Mother the Car.
And he chose My Mother the Car.
My Mother the Car. And in his defense, I have to believe this, he said, and, you know, both shows were backed by you know, talented people. My Mother the Car, infamously, was one of the worst shows ever. It was about a guy who buys a car, or maybe a used car at a car lot, and it turns out to be the reincarnation of his mother, who's voiced by Ann Southern, and he would turn on the radio and his mother would start talking to him. That was the ridiculous premise of the show.
So it was like an analog version of Knight Rider.
Or Mr. Ed.
Yeah, okay. You know?
Or I think spinoff of like, oh, a talking horse will have a talking car. So in his defense, Jerry Van Dyke said, you know, when I read those scripts, believe me, My Mother the Car read like Shakespeare compared to Gilligan's Island. So I have to go, he has a point. He has a point. I bet the pilot was a hell of a lot better than Gilligan's Island, which is certainly a dreadful show. It just turned out to be a hit. So he was eternally befuddled, bounced around for a long, long time, lots of roles and lots of things, never quite made it, but he did eventually as the second banana on Coach.
Yeah, that was a big, I think he was nominated for Emmys, right?
He got four Emmy nominations during the run of Coach, and he was still working right up to the end. He's on the middle playing the dad or the older brother to Patricia. No, I think he's playing her dad. He must have been. So that's a cute little show, and he was, you know, working right up to the end.
I didn't know he had passed away, so thanks for letting me know, but I didn't know.
Well, that, and you know, thank you to all our listeners for listening in. That's all I can say. We're sorry for the 2-week break. We hope you had a great holiday, and we hope we got through stuff and we're back on fire for you. And you'll be listening in the new year. Maybe soon you'll have a chance to help support us.
That's true. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, or Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, or wherever they give podcasts away for free. If you can't find us, let us know. Write to us, call us, find us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That's where you can like us. What else should I say? Oh, well, we have a website, showbizsandbox.com, which is where you'll find not only our episodes, our past episodes, this one included, but links to all of the stories we've discussed on this episode. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. We have a website, showbizsandbox.com. They have a website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's freethemet.com.
See earlier in the show for the reference there. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out Book Filter to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.